court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
I've just been informed by my trusty co-host that we have an update.
We have an update on our sullied Chief Justice Lowry. His reputation has been sullied.
It has, and so was his couch.
Yeah, and a lot more people than me heard you say sexual couch, too, and they were interested in what's a sexual couch.
I'm interested in that as well.
No wonder it's tweeting. Tweeting and twerking.
So what's the update?
Well, the update is that the governor called a special session of our legislators so they could come and meet to do an investigation and decide whether to impeach Chief Justice Lowry or not. So they're waiting for the House to finish their investigation so they can decide if they're going to impeach him. And then if he does, of course, then the Senate, as we've gone over before, takes the action to actually decide whether to remove him or not.
I think it's probably safe to go ahead and call him former Chief Justice Lowry.
Yeah, well, I think he's going to quit and walk away.
Yeah. Now, you had said that there was another West Virginia politician that had been impeached before. And I remember this a little bit, but it's a little bit older, so it's kind of when I was a little bit younger, so I don't remember it.
Well, and this was a very colorful character named A. James Manchin.
I remember the name, and I remember him a little bit.
And he always wore these big black suits and black boots and a big black cowboy hat and everywhere he go. And he was, by all means, a character. I mean, in all definitions, he was a character, bigger than life. And He was the state treasurer, I believe.
Yeah.
And he oversaw the investment of the state funds to the tune of a loss of like $279 million or something like that.
Yeah.
And at that point, they impeached him to remove him from office. And before the Senate could vote on it, he actually resigned.
Before he was convicted?
Yeah.
I guess he initially had vowed to stay in office. But if he had been convicted by the Senate, that would have meant that he would have lost his eligibility to run for office again, and it could have actually cost him his pension, because he was kind of a lifelong
politician absolutely.
And civil servant. So he resigned before the trial to avoid those kinds of sanctions. And he actually did later run for the House of Delegates in 1998 and served in the House of Delegates until he died in 2003.
Well, it doesn't matter if you're crooked in West Virginia. He was one of the ones that Chief Justice Lowry wrote that book about. He was probably heavily referred to in that. He was a typical West Virginia politician with the dirty backdoor deals and everything else.
The House of Delegates, they called him a flamboyant character of the first magnitude.
Absolutely, he was. And I can remember one time I had gone up. There was a friend of mine when I was in college at Marshall, and one of my best friends growing up, he went to college at WVU. I've since forgiven him for that, but he went to college up there. So he invited me to come up and watch a WVU football game with him one weekend. So I went up with him for the weekend, and I was driving back to Huntington. And on the way back, now this was before 79 was built, so it was mostly all back roads driving back and forth to Morgantown. And there was a big black limousine in front of me. And I mean, that thing was getting it. It was doing like about 85 miles an hour. I just stayed right on his tail.
Yeah.
And just followed this guy. And I followed him most of the way from Morgantown to the exit at Charleston, where you could get back on 64.
Yeah.
And I followed him almost the entire way from Morgantown down there. I didn't have any idea who I was following, but I knew it was somebody that knew more about whether there's going to be cops out there than me. So I followed him the whole way. As we got off the exit, this thing kind of like, I won't say he screeched to a halt, but he came to a pretty quick stop at the bottom of the ramp, and the door opened, and this guy wheels out of there and puts on a big black cowboy hat, and it was A. James Mansion. And he came walking back to my car, and I'm looking up thinking, what is this guy going to do?
Yeah.
And I knew who he was because I'd met him because my mother, being in the legislature, I'd met him, and he was such a flamboyant character.
The first magnitude.
Yeah, you'd remember him. And so he came back to my car, and he goes, how are you doing, young man? And I said, well, I'm doing fine. He goes, I noticed you followed us most of the way back here from Morgantown. Were you up there for the football game? And I said, yeah, sure was. He, it was a good game, wasn't it? Yeah, it was a good game. He goes, well, I just wanted you to know I'm A. James Mansion, and I want you to be careful out there on the roads. I said, oh, that's why I'm following you. I figured I was in good hands. And he tipped that big cowboy hat to me and got back in his car. I was just a college kid. I was looking at him like, man, I won't tell him who my mom is.
That's pretty funny. He must have looked out the back and seen you following him the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. I stayed right on his bumper. He was doing 85, and I thought, I'm going to make pretty good time getting back home. Because that was 55 mile an hour back country road we were driving on.
Yeah, and back then with inflation, 85 is probably like 105 now or something.
Yeah, that's about right. Gas was only a nickel a gallon.
Well, just think about how much that $279 million was back then.
Yeah, that was a lot of money.
Yeah. I don't know. Was he actually like, did he squander the money or did he just misinvest it, I think?
He made some very poor business decisions in what he invested in. I think that he may have been getting kickbacks by choosing these investments. People steered him towards it and he got certain kickbacks in return for it. I don't know if that was part of the impeachment, whether they got into that or not, because of course they never were able to prosecute him, so all that went away. But I think there was some personal dealings involved. I will say he was either from Logan or Mingo County, so that should explain most of it right there.
No, I think he was from Fairmont. He was from up north.
Was he?
Yeah,
I was thinking
so.
He was from down the other way. Well, now I've sullied them for no reason. Of course, not really no reason. They got plenty of other stuff that they've done.
He was born in Farmington, West Virginia.
Oh, you know who else was from there? A. James Mansion. I mean, Joe Mansion.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I think he's related.
I bet they are. Yeah, so that's actually Fairmont, too.
I would have to say they are definitely have to be related. A. James Mansion, Joe Mansion. I mean, they're not father and son, but I think he's probably an uncle or something.
I have to be.
Yeah.
There's only so many mansions in town.
And from Farmington. That's where Joe's from.
Is he really?
Yeah. I knew that. I just didn't know that's where A. James was from.
Yep, that's where his family's from. So they probably are related.
I would have to say so.
Well, this episode is not about West Virginia politics.
The last one was,
and that was where we had the update. This episode was actually suggested to us by Jen Pauly. There was a recent decision that came out, and it was the South Dakota versus Wayfair case.
Don't wreck your car, Jen. See, Christopher Steer said he almost wrecked when he heard his name.
That's
listening
right.
To it, when he mentioned him last time.
Keep him at 10 and 2. And then also Shane Gordon suggested it might be a good time for an episode on the Dormant Commerce Clause.
The Dormant Commerce Clause?
Yeah.
Well, he's up north right now. He's dormant because it's not Christmas. Remember, that's Santa's brother.
The guy who counts all the money?
Yeah, Commerce Clause.
So we did talk about the Commerce Clause one time before in a previous episode.
Right.
I don't know which one it was, and I'm sorry I can't cite to it directly.
It was back around Christmas.
It was. Ho, ho, ho. So what is the Dormant Commerce Clause, and where did it originate?
I have no idea. I've never heard of that. I've heard of the Commerce Clause, but not the dormant one.
Had you heard of the Commerce Clause before we did the episode on it?
No. Okay. I had not heard of it before then.
So to talk about the Dormant Commerce Clause, we probably need to lay some sort of foundation about the active Commerce Clause. I've actually never heard it called that. I'm just using it to clarify. So it's just the Commerce Clause.
So there's a Commerce Clause and a Dormant Commerce Clause. So
that's
there's
right.
Two different, they're actually two different clauses.
Well, kind of.
Or is it like the Santa Clause 1 and 2? It's just an extension of the same one.
I don't know. I've never seen those. Is that with Tim Allen?
Yeah. I had to explain to you what was going on with them.
That's right, you did.
Yeah, and that was bad. I'm not good at explaining movies. Mary hates me to tell her about movies.
Now, the Commerce Clause is an enumerated power that's listed in the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. And it states that the U.S. Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And that's what, basically, that's the basis for the Commerce Clause. It's actually enumerated, and by enumerated, I mean it's written. Some things that are in the Constitution aren't actually in there, but they're kind of perceived to be in there based upon different decisions. But this is actually pen and ink written in there.
So Section 1, that one.
Section 1, that one?
Yeah. Section 8, Clause 3.
Section Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, yes.
Section 8, Clause 3. So 8 beat 3, so they won.
Now, the Commerce Clause is generally used in conjunction with the Necessary and Proper Clause, and it has been used by Congress to create pretty broad, expansive powers for themselves. This especially began around 1937, when the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the federal price regulation of intrastate milk commerce, basically milk commerce within a state. So it definitely wasn't interstate, but it was intrastate, but they upheld it under the Commerce Clause and said, "The commerce power is not confined in its exercise to the regulation of commerce among the states. It extends to those activities intrastate which so affect interstate commerce or the exertion of a power of Congress over it as to make regulation of them appropriate means to the attainment of a legitimate end. The effective execution and granted power regulate interstate commerce. The power of Congress over interstate commerce is plenary and complete in itself, may be exercised to its utmost extent, and acknowledges no limitations other than are prescribed in the Constitution. It follows that no form of state activity can constitutionally thwart the regulatory power granted by the Commerce Clause to Congress. Hence, the reach of that power extends to those intrastate activities which in a substantial way interfere or otherwise exercise of the granted power." So basically they're saying,
man, my head hurts after hearing that. What? Yeah, give me some layman terms.
Is your brain thwarted?
Yeah, it's starting to swell.
So basically it's saying, if it can touch on interstate commerce whatsoever, even though it might be physically contained inside one state, it doesn't matter. Congress can still have the power to regulate it based on that basis.
Oh, were people trying to say, if we don't cross into another state, then you can't use that clause against us?
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh,
the Congress
okay.
doesn't have the power to it because the way that
then it's a state
reads,
thing.
It says among the several states. So among meaning like it has to be between the states, not necessarily just in a state.
Oh.
And so you have to remember, too, this whole thing, there's been a constant struggle, and there still kind of is to this day, between state power versus federal power. And this is kind of part of the interplay. And there's definitely some shifts and some ebbs and flows of what takes place with regards to that.
Well, I mean, that's one of my complaints with politics. Because who is it that always advocates that the states should decide everything?
States?
The Republicans.
No.
And who is it that advocates the federal government should decide everything? The Democrats. And it shouldn't be like that. It ought to be what you're representing people from your district. What benefits the people from your district? That's how you should make that decision if you're a representative, because you're representing those people. So you need to represent their interest, not the interest of some party.
Well, that's the problem with party politics in general. So
yeah. Well, this is one of the things. That's what I think of when you think of states' rights. The Republicans are always banging on states' rights, when the Democrats are always banging on let the federal government do it.
Yeah. That's kind of a breakdown for it to a certain degree. Although I do think you kind of run the risk of
overgeneralizing.
Yeah, overgeneralizing, doing the same thing with that too, because I don't think the Republicans necessarily always have state rights in mind. I think they do when it fits their agenda to a certain degree.
Well,
so
I'll agree with you that, let's just say, the agenda of party politics is not the agenda of us common man.
It is not. So now that 1937 case, that's basically when the court began to defer to Congress, and that basically the theory was that if the legislation affected commerce, then it was appropriate for Congress to be able to legislate some sort of law. And this basically changed the court's reasoning with that, because before that it kind of was more towards states' rights. So this actually shifted it. And that was actually one of the reasons that people used a lot when they were talking about civil liberties and things like that throughout the 60s and whatnot. So that was kind of the federal government used that as a basis to step in on a lot of these different things, kind of on the toes of some states' rights to a certain degree. Now,
like on segregation and stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly.
And instead of letting states decide if schools could remain segregated or something. The federal policy came down that they won't.
That's right. And I mean, they use basically this to use all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's just crazy the different things. And this basically went on until there was a decision in 1995, maybe 96, but it was U.S. v. Lopez. And that was what kind of started this other shift now to reining in the Commerce Clause and making it less used. Because Lopez was basically Congress had enacted a gun-free school zone law, basically saying that we want to have schools be gun-free, and so we're going to make that a federal law. Mm-hmm. And they said, it's related to commerce. That's why we're doing it. And so basically the Supreme Court heard that, and this was Justice Rehnquist, his court, and he basically said, no, I think, you know, that's enough is enough. That's not really related to Congress.
Yeah, that's kind of a stretch, I think.
Well, a lot of the things they did were basically kind of stretches.
Yeah, I mean, relating schools' safety to interstate commerce.
I mean, I can kind of see it a little bit, but on that ground, if you're going that far, I think you can probably relate just about anything to interstate commerce.
Well, what a 180, I guess, not a 360. You'd be back where you started. It's a 180. Here they're talking about gun-free zones in schools, and now we're talking about arming teachers?
Yeah, exactly. It's Man. Kind of strange. It's a strange world we live in.
Yeah, it's a 20 years and complete 180 in how we think about it, huh?
It's a pretty quick shift, really.
Yeah.
Now, now that we know kind of what the Commerce Clause is, I can actually start talking about the Dormant Commerce Clause.
Well, that's true, because I guess it's different, huh?
It is.
Otherwise, it'd have the same name.
They kind of do still.
Well, they do kind of. But it's like a junior. You know, if you're a junior, you're not the same person as the original.
No, and, you know, like a Whopper Junior is not the same as a Whopper. It's
That's right. It's smaller.
It's smaller.
I like double Whoppers myself.
I like
it. They're not the same as a Whopper.
A double Whopper Junior.
Well, that's a waste. Why just get a Whopper if you're going to get a double Whopper Junior? That's redundant.
But before we get into the Dormant Commerce Clause, I think there's some motions today.
Well, yes, Your Honorship, Supreme
Justice
Impeachment Ship Person. We would like to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
All right. Approach. Who's on the docket today?
We have on the docket our best friends at DollarShaveClub.com.
Now, I know some of you out there, you shower, you shave.
Some of you.
You brush your teeth. You try to make your hair look presentable.
Hopefully.
We've got good news for you. Dollar Shave Club has all the stuff you need to help you out with that.
That's right. I try to bathe on a regular basis.
It's a good idea.
I find it's better when you're, you know, involved with living with other humans.
At a certain age, all you want to do is just look clean.
Just look clean?
Or be clean. I don't know.
How about be clean?
Be clean. Be clean. Use Dollar Shave Club.
But their products that they have are just absolutely top notch. I love every one of them that we have purchased and used. The soaps, the shave lotion, the body butter, not body butter. What is it?
I think that's something else. Whoa, I don't want to get into that.
If they had a body butter, I guarantee you it would be good.
I think what Tommy's trying to say is they have everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best.
And to slide right on through the door.
So, Dollar Shave Club has everything you need to get ready in the bathroom.
Any particular product that you have fallen in love with outside of the razor, and why?
I think that was a question for you to answer.
Oh, any particular product that I have fallen in love with outside of the razor? Well, yes, I have.
I love the body butter.
I love the body butter. It's shave butter, right?
Yes, it's shave butter.
Yeah, that's close. Body butter, shave butter. Shave better with your body butter.
Well, Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it. Shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even a wipe that'll leave your tush feeling tingly clean.
Tingly. I'm a big fan of their Amber and Lavender Calming Body Cleanser. I've never smelled anything like it. And good luck to finding a product that great at the store.
Okay. All of Dollar Shave Club's products are made with top shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. You'll feel the difference. Plus, shipping is included with your membership.
Even on the body butter.
That's right. Shave butter.
Oh, body butter's better. And here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with body cleanser, one wipe Charlie's
for your butt,
their amazing butt wipes, their world-famous shave butter, and their best razor, the 6-Blade Executive.
Keep the blades coming for a few bucks more a month, and add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need for the bathroom.
Check it all out at dollarshaveclub.com/court.
That's dollarshaveclub.com/court.
Tell them Mike and Tommy sent you, and slip on through the door with that body butter.
So, the dormant commerce clause.
It hibernates during the winter? Is that what it does? It only comes out in the spring?
It's sometimes called the negative commerce clause, and it's basically a legal doctrine that courts in the United States have inferred from the commerce clause. And the dormant commerce clause is basically used to prohibit state legislation that discriminates against interstate or international commerce. So the word dormant is actually not used in the Constitution. It comes, the first time it was actually used was by our school benefactor, Chief Justice John Marshall, in some dicta in a case, Gibbons v. Ogden, in 1824.
We are the sons of Marshall, sons of the great John Marshall. You know the rest.
Kind of. I always want to say the wrong words.
I'll fix it for you.
Thanks. Anyway, John Marshall wrote that the power to regulate interstate commerce can never be exercised by the people themselves, but must be placed in the hands of agents or lie dormant. And he said that in some dicta in one of his, in the opinion there.
In some dicta.
In some dicta.
What's some dicta? What was that?
Dicta?
Some dicta?
Well, it's funny you should ask.
Some dicta.
Dicta.
I know what I'm thinking, but I don't think it's the same thing.
Dicta is kind of what lawyers and different people, law professors say when they refer to some sort of statement by the court that's basically kind of outside the purview of what the court's actually talking about. So it's actually not binding authority under, like, you know, the principle of stare decisis. So basically it's not something that binds somebody. It's basically just has kind of a persuasive effect, and it's mentioned in the opinion, but it's not actually like a legal opinion on that actual issue. So he just kind of just threw that out, just throwing this out there.
Is that S-U-M some or S-O-M-E some? Some dicta?
No, it's just dicta.
Oh, I thought you were saying like it was two words together, some dicta.
No.
Oh,
like
it's just dicta.
Yeah, just dicta.
See, I thought it was like some is a Latin word, and I thought it was like some dicta.
No.
Okay.
No, just dicta.
Just dicta?
Just stick to the dicta.
Dicta? Dicta? I didn't even kiss her.
And so, as I said, he said, yeah, basically that in the dicta that it can never be exercised by the people themselves, but must be placed in the hands of agents or lie dormant. And Justice William Johnson concurred.
There was a dicta and a Johnson.
That's right. He said that the Constitution is altogether in favor of the exclusive grants to Congress of power over commerce. So basically they're talking that, say, they're kind of laying the groundwork for this dormant commerce clause with that opinion. And they're saying, hey, Congress alone has the power to regulate this interstate commerce. No one else does. The states don't do that. The people don't do that.
Hmm.
So.
And then did he say, you doesn't have to call me Johnson. You can call me Ray J.
And so you have to think about back to the time, and this is, again, something we're still talking about, is the debate and the struggle between states' rights and the federal government. So back then, and this actually even harkens back to a theme in the play Hamilton, is that Federalists wanted a strong federal government. And right. You can contrast that with the Republicans who wanted state rights, like you said. Mm-hmm. Hamilton was actually a Federalist. If you remember from the musical, he wrote the Federalist Papers and wanted a strong federal government. And he wanted it basically run by kind of well-educated, smart people.
That's the establishment of the national treasury.
That's right. Thomas Jefferson, on the other hand, he was a Democratic Republican and wanted more power with the states and the farmers and the common man. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to reside with the states. So I think this was kind of probably shots fired for the Federalists by them putting this in the dicta. Mm-hmm. So saying, hey, we want the federal government to be a bit stronger on these kinds of things. We want to keep the states out. Let's keep their nose out of this.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. Most of the ones that were running our government were the aristocrats.
Yeah.
They figured the rest of those, you know, those dumb hillbillies and farmers and stuff, we don't want them making decisions. They don't know what they're doing. We're the smart ones. That's why we're here.
Fair enough. And so now the Dormant Commerce Clause has kind of evolved through the years, because you would think that basically that if there was a federal power, it was like an exclusive federal power, meaning that the states couldn't go there at all.
Don't go there.
Just don't go there. But actually, interstate commerce...
Oh, no, you didn't.
...is somewhat of a concurrent power when Congress has not entered the field or preempted the field. And it's an exclusive power when Congress legislates in that area and essentially does preempt the field. So you can think about it as being kind of the Dormant Commerce Clause, that if Congress has legislated in that area, then the states cannot do it. And if the Congress has not legislated in that area, then the states can kind of stick their nose in there a little bit.
They can try.
Yeah.
But they might get their nose stepped on.
Yeah, and it basically has kind of also modified into this area of a fair play between the states to a certain extent. Justice Kennedy has written before that the central rationale for the rule against discrimination is to prohibit state or municipal laws whose object is local economic protectionism, laws that would excite those jealousies and retaliatory measures the Constitution was designed to prevent.
So I wonder what these justices are thinking of sometimes.
Big words is what they're thinking of.
Well, but when excite their what?
Those jealousies and retaliatory
excite
measures.
Excite those jealousies.
Yeah. So basically what they're trying to say is that if there is some sort of economic protectionism going on in one state to hurt another state, that's going to violate essentially the Dormant Commerce Clause too. Even though it might not be an area where the federal government has elected to go, by doing that kind of behavior, that's going to violate it too.
Well, I guess so. It's like that states can't enact tariffs on things coming in from other states and things like that.
Yeah, pretty much.
So that they could get exclusive things for theirs.
Yeah.
Products being built in their own state or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, one area you might think of is that I know a lot of places, I think Georgia and North Carolina in particular, they have major tax breaks for people that film movies and whatnot there, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of movies are filmed in these places.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess you could kind of... It's not really...
That's not unfair, though. That's just trying to attract business.
That's true.
West Virginia tried that, and they didn't get any business. So now they took the law out. They said, well, nobody was coming here anyway, so they took it out.
We'll show you.
We'll take away those tax breaks you didn't use.
So... In order basically to determine whether or not the law violated the dormant aspect of the Commerce Clause, the court usually looks at whether or not, on its face, it discriminates against interstate commerce. So that's kind of the barometer they use. And discrimination means that basically there's different treatment of in-state and out-of-state economic interests that benefits the in-state and hurts the out-of-state. So if there's any kind of hanky-panky going on to help the home team, it's not allowed.
Okay.
So...
I can think of one that took place that to me is a little bit suspect.
What's that?
The change to the pricing on the toll booths on the turnpike.
Okay.
Have you seen that?
Where basically they're selling something to in-state residents for like a $10 pass, whereas if it's out of state, you probably still could get it, couldn't you?
Well, maybe, but it's like $5 now to go through toll booths. It used to be like 75 cents.
Yeah.
And it went up to like a dollar, then it was a couple dollars. Now it's like $5. Per toll booth to go on the turnpike, and I think you can get a pass for like $45. So in other words, if you're just going to pass through the state once, you're not going to buy a $45 pass, you just pay the $15.
Yeah.
But if you're in state and you drive up and down that road all the time, you pay $45, well, you make your money back in 2 days or 3 days, something like that, you know?
Well, I know in Florida they had the turnpike and the toll booths and things like that, and anybody could basically buy the little sunshine sticker you stuck on your windshield to blow through them.
Right.
But, I mean, so it wasn't really just for local people versus out of state. But I think it probably did benefit the local people more, because why would you want to go ahead and go through all that hassle when you could just...
Exactly.
You know, whatever, so...
Yeah, that's what I mean. I know that, yeah, technically anybody could buy one, but technically not everybody benefits from one. So, I don't know. It's a way of not imposing too big a burden on the people of your state... and passing that burden over to the people coming through your state.
Yeah. Now, I mean, if they make it different for West Virginians versus out-of-state people, I think you might have a bit of a problem there.
West Virginians didn't have to pay anything?
Yeah, possibly. I could see that. So, I mean, that could see where that would probably be a different treatment of in-state versus out-of-state economic interests.
Yeah.
Now, I know one area where it doesn't matter is in, like, hunting and fishing license, because there's an in-state price and an out-of-state price. But again, you got to think, if you're hunting and fishing, that's basically within that state.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's definitely, I mean, although some places out west, people travel to go hunt in different areas, so it does kind of affect interstate commerce. But I think that's one of those areas where it's best left to the states to be able to do what they need to do.
Well, that's because they're going to remove it from our streams or forests if they're from out of state, where if they're in state, it'll still stay here.
They're stealing all that good deer burger.
That's right. They're running them down and taking them home back across the border to Maryland or Pennsylvania, Virginia, Ohio, Kentucky. All them states we border.
I think you named them all there. Did you get Virginia?
Yeah.
Okay.
The mother homeland.
So now that brings us to the case that Jess mentioned, the newly decided, which is South Dakota versus Wayfair. And basically, to kind of give you a short synopsis, this case essentially opens the doors for states to collect sales tax from online retailers. The Supreme Court had previously held that interstate commerce may be required to pay its fair share of state taxes in 1988. Now, there's two decisions, Bellis Hess in 1967 and Quill in 1992, and they stated that there must be a physical presence requirement for a state sales tax. So that basically if a company has no physical presence, such as a warehouse or storefront in your state, you can't require it to collect taxes no matter how much stuff it's shipping to state residents or how much money it's making doing from it. But now the internet's kind of gotten bigger, and it's made it easier and easier to buy items from sellers in other states. The result has been kind of an unfair advantage for online retailers, and states' budgets have actually lost tax revenue because of this.
Yeah, absolutely, because you've got a lot of brick-and-mortar buildings that are closing up. I mean, you look at Sears and Penny's and things like that. They're all going out of business. Kmart closed down. You know, things like that, that are all, we're producing state dollars, you know, tax revenue in their states, and they're no longer there. And it's all going to the Amazons and people like that that are doing it online. So, yeah, that's what I think caused this whole controversy, is the states were screaming about their lost revenue and wanting their share of the pie.
That made me think of a quote from one of your favorite movies. Yep, first the silver run out, then the people run out, then the whiskey run out, then the beer run out. Remember that from Outlaw Jesse Wales?
I sure do.
But yeah, it's kind of the same thing. It's like first the Kmart run out.
Yeah. Well, they did. They're all closing down, and that's because everybody's going to this online shipping.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's hard to say. It is pretty convenient.
Yeah. I mean, that's you know, it's the same thing in a lot of industries that have gone through the changes happen, and if you're not one of the ones out in front doing it, then you're going to get run over by it. That's like, just the way things go.
It's like the No Effects song, Dinosaurs Will Die.
Yeah, Blockbuster. Look at Blockbuster. Well, you can't. They're not there.
There's probably one out there somewhere, some independently owned Blockbuster.
He's still probably waiting to get back videotapes and charge you for your late fee and because you didn't rewind.
And they're out there probably serving McDonald's pizzas, too.
It's yeah.
A hybrid Blockbuster / McDonald's pizzeria. Now, the South Dakota law, they basically saw this Quill decision from 1992 and said, yeah, we don't really care what that says. We're going to do whatever we want anyway. And they passed a law which requires sales tax collection from all companies that sold at least $100,000 in merchandise and services or 200 separate orders to South Dakota addresses annually. So basically, if it's $100,000 in merchandise or services or 200 separate orders to South Dakota, you have to collect sales tax.
For South Dakota. Mm-hmm.
They said that's where they're drawing the line in the sand. And
they would have a hard time proving that, though.
I think they would.
Because they're not privy to your personal records.
No, and it's probably going to be a lot of self-reporting.
Yeah.
So basically, the Supreme Court said, you know what, we're going to overrule this Quill decision, and they upheld that law. They said, you know what, that's South Dakota law. The pat looks okay to us.
Hmm.
Now, Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority opinion, and was joined in by Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So you kind of have a mixing of different people on that court, not just kind of conservative liberal, but it's basically just all over the place.
Did they give any insight into why they agreed with it or what they thought that it was correcting or fixing or keeping from happening or something?
Yeah, they did. And, I mean, there's a full opinion about it. The majority opinion said that basically the physical presence requirement previously outlined in that quill, basically saying that you had to have a physical presence in the state, that it was arbitrary and unworkable, especially in the modern economy, and applied a different test from a case called Complete Auto Transit, one that requires a substantial nexus rather than specifically a physical one. There were different concurring opinions by Thomas and Gorsuch, which indicated they might consider killing or revamping the entire concept of the Dormant Commerce Clause, as Congress has the authority to do X does not necessarily imply that states are forbidden to do X if Congress doesn't, or that courts get to set the limits of state policy. So This was kind of a big blow against the Dormant Commerce Clause.
All right, so
it's probably really dormant now.
But this was recent Supreme Court ruling?
Yeah.
Is what this was? So all this did was okay what they're doing in South Dakota.
Yes.
But what we're saying is that there's going to be fallout because now all states are going to start enacting their own decision on this. Is that what we're to draw from this?
Probably so, because they're going to want to recoup those sales taxes from these online retailers because it's going to help their bottom line.
And they're going to put in these same, but they're going to all decide what their requirements are.
Yeah.
And some of them, I wonder if they even have to have it. I wonder if they could just say, hey, anybody you do business with, we want you to collect West Virginia sales tax if they're in West Virginia, and you send it to us.
Well, I mean, they did lay out a test that requires a substantial nexus. So basically, there's got to be some sort of linkage there, not just, I think, you ship something there one time. So, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, well, it's going to be hard to track.
It will be.
You know, I think that one of the main things that is a scary part about this, nobody cares about Amazon or Walmart.com. They've got people, they've got money, they've got computers to keep records and generate all this stuff. They'll be fine.
Well, and also, but here's the thing too, Amazon and Walmart, they probably already would meet that physical presence requirement anyway.
In most states.
Not all, but most. They'd meet it here in Huntington, West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
There's a big Amazon facility.
Yeah.
There's Walmarts here. I mean, so yeah. I think that the bigger retailers, it probably doesn't matter as much. What this is going to hurt and stifle more is probably these kind of mid-range
type retailers. Yeah, there's a lot of online industries that have popped up that people are doing things online, and that's their sole support. Now, all of a sudden, they've got to start tracking how many they send to here and how many they send to there. And then also, they're going to have to raise their prices to collect the taxes. And then they've got to keep a way of sending those taxes. You've got to file with each one of these states and send them their taxes either monthly or quarterly and stuff like that. That's a lot of paperwork to try to keep up with for a small business.
Yeah. There's some examples of different things that can take place here, and I'm going to kind of give you some examples. This one article said, what is really happening when a South Dakotan orders a piece of furniture from Wayfair? Wayfair was the furniture store in there.
Right.
The sale does not take place in South Dakota. If it takes place anywhere, it takes place on the internet and servers that support Wayfair's website. Wayfair has no physical presence in South Dakota. The servers are probably not located there. And the sale takes place on the internet. It takes place through a medium of interstate commerce, just like orders previously sent through the mail or telephone.
Right.
So
yeah, it's no different than calling in and ordering some.
Yeah. And so basically, if the sale does not take place in South Dakota, what is South Dakota really taxing? Is it taxing the act of shipping the customer's goods across state lines? I mean, it kind of is.
What it's taxing is, it's taxing the lost revenue. It's saying that you didn't put a store in here for us to be able to sell it here and collect the taxes, so we're going to go ahead and grab it from you anyway.
Right, but their rationale is that essentially the only thing that's really taking place is the shipping to South Dakota. Because nothing else happens in South Dakota.
Right, which the majority of that isn't even in South Dakota. It's not till they arrive that they're in South Dakota. They might have shipped it from California.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. There was a lot of other states involved there, and they didn't get anything out of it.
Yeah. The one,
and they were completely penetrated.
The one article I saw said basically this is some sort of interstate tariff, basically, is what it's going to amount to. And it's basically intended to equalize the prices of cross-border sales compared to in-state sales, and that doesn't really change the fact. So it's basically trying to, I guess, kind of homogenize things across the country to a certain degree. This other example I saw said, consider, for example, two businesses that sell furniture online. The first stocks a few items of inventory in a small warehouse in North Sioux City, South Dakota. The second uses a major warehouse just across the border in South Sioux City, Nebraska. Maintains a sophisticated website and a virtual showroom accessible in every state, including South Dakota. By reason of its physical presence, the first business must collect and remit tax on all of its sales to customers from South Dakota, even those sales that have nothing to do with the warehouse. But under Quill, the second hypothetical seller cannot be subject to the same tax for the sales of the same items made through the same internet presence. So really, that physical presence thing doesn't really make much sense either if you think about it.
No.
So it really, neither one of these, I think, makes much sense. And the real problem is that, you know, Congress has seen this coming for quite some time, or maybe they haven't, and they've elected not to do anything about it.
Well, so, that's typical.
Yeah. Now, I know when I living in Florida, I often had to pay sales tax to online retailers who were located in Florida. Out-of-state ones, I didn't have to. And I would sometimes choose the out-of-state ones just because it was a better price without tax on it.
Right.
But if you think about it, it's not really any different than, like, us going across the river to Ohio to get a break on gas prices if the taxes is less there.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to it. But I really don't think the physical presence thing is a perfect fix for it either.
Well, I mean, there's two different groups that are being harmed in this. First of all, the consumers are having to pay more. And second of all, you've got certain levels of business, small to medium to large, that are being affected because of the amount of paperwork and documentation they're going to have to keep to be able to keep up with this and do it properly and not get themselves in trouble.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's placing a large burden on it. And I know that states want their money, but I don't know, maybe they should just put a flat rate on it. And all the money goes in a pool, and then you have some type of ratio where at the end of the year it goes to each of the states based on their ratio of population or purchases or something like that.
That sounds confusing.
Their gross national product.
Their GNP.
Yeah. You know, now, something like that. I don't know, but there's got to be a way to streamline this, because if every state starts implementing their own version of this, I feel sorry for anybody that does their work on the internet and has got to keep up with all that.
Oh, it's going to create a mess.
Yeah.
I don't know if the court actually thought about the ramifications of this. Or maybe they're saying, you know what, Congress, fix this.
Well, that could be.
So basically, the court has effectively overruled that Quill case with the physical presence doctrine. Just some interesting facts. When Quill was decided in 1992, less than 2% of Americans had internet access.
Mm-hmm.
89% today have internet access. When Quill was decided, the court could not have envisioned a world in which the world's largest retailer would be a remote seller, namely Amazon, is what Kennedy said in the opinion.
Right.
In 1992, mail order sales in the United States totaled $180 billion, and e-commerce last year alone were $453.5
billion. So, yeah, it used to be the only thing you got mail order was brides.
Is that true?
I guess so. I've always heard of mail order brides.
I used to get video games mail order. There was this catalog that came and had all these awesome Commodore 64 games.
Oh, and you could get like 10 of them for a nickel or a penny or something?
No, those were the tapes. It was like BMG with those tapes.
Yeah, that's right.
So, one funny article I was reading about this, it said, there was a quote, it said, Congress uses the Interstate Commerce Clause as an excuse to regulate the cultivation of marijuana for private use, for crying out loud. It might as well use it to, you know, regulate interstate commerce. Because if you think about it, they're using the Commerce Clause to regulate marijuana. Mm-hmm. So why shouldn't they use the Commerce Clause to actually regulate commerce?
Sure.
That's a novel idea, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what Quill, you keep quoting the case, the Quill case, you know what Quill was, don't you?
What?
Or still is, I guess.
What?
They were an office product company.
Were they really?
Yeah. And that's what they were shipping, was office products. And they were one of the first ones to do that.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Oh.
Pens and pencils and erasers and furniture. And
do they have Quill pens?
Probably.
Hmm.
I would guess so with a name like that. Unless they were just that old. They've been around since that was the pen of use, before the fountain came along, or the ballpoint.
What is it, a fountain pen? What is a fountain pen? It's the one that has like little cartridges you stick in.
I guess. I don't know. There's a fountain pen and there's a ballpoint pen. There's ones that had a magic gliding ball.
I don't know much about pens. I know what I like.
You know what you like?
Yeah.
You used to have a pen made out of coal.
You did?
Yeah.
The whole thing?
Well, not the pen itself. I mean, not the writing.
The ink?
The cartridge thing with the needle was there, but the shell around it was a shaved piece of coal.
A hard coal shell?
Yeah. Hard coal, cold shell.
Well, I think that's going to do it and bring us to...
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we go over different legal terms we talked about. It's probably going to be me asking Tommy lots of questions about what we just talked about.
Yeah, because I don't know nothing. Man, today was a confusing one.
Well, do you have a better grasp on it, you think, though?
I'll try to grasp at straws.
I mean, do you understand the Commerce Clause, the Dormant Commerce Clause, and have some ideas about the taxation, things like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Taxation without representation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the real question is when does it become a taxable event? That's
the lingo that gets you by law school.
So the first phrase or first question is, what is dicta?
Dicta? That's when the Supreme Court justices are talking, and they're just kind of talking off the cuff, and it's not really anything about the actual decision. It's just kind of some guidelines that they put in there, and they usually get picked up there and used in other rulings later on. That's just their dicta. I guess it comes from something to do with dictation or something.
Well, it's just kind of also like...
how they got to their conclusion.
Dictum is another word, another
form
of that word. And the important thing, though, is that dicta is something else that's in an opinion. It's not necessarily what the opinion itself is about.
Right.
And so, therefore, it's not necessarily binding.
But people may refer to it in later cases, say, this is what Justice Marshall was thinking when he did it by his dicta, something or another.
Exactly. It's not binding on the principles of stare decisis, but it does have a strong persuasive effect.
And somebody said, you can't listen to him. He's a dicta.
So what is the Commerce Clause?
The Commerce Clause governs all commerce that takes place throughout the U.S. and interstate commerce. So they use it to pass whatever kind of law they want referring to something. And they just say it affects interstate commerce. Therefore, we got the right to do it.
And then this all changed in pretty much in 1995
or 6.
And what was the name of that case that changed that? We've talked about it a couple of times. It's a bonus question here.
It wasn't Roe v. Wade. No, it was something, though. It had a name like that, though.
It was U.S. v. Lopez.
Lopez. Well, that's right. It's kind of like Roe. Lopez, Roe.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Kind of close there. Yeah. And that was the one about where they wanted to have gun-free zones in schools based upon the Commerce Clause.
Yeah.
And Justice Rehnquist basically said, no, that's enough of that. You're overstepping your bounds. Stay in your lane.
And pretty soon, Donald Trump was going to come along and arm all the teachers anyway, so that will be a conflict.
And now... we talked about the Commerce Clause. Can you explain what the Dormant Commerce Clause is?
Well, that's the one that's not active, like the Active Commerce Clause. It's a dormant one. It's just laying there. It's the one that says, look, I'm here just in case you states start trying to do something. Actually, it's what the states can do if nobody has actually done anything with the Commerce Clause. Then they can edge in there and do something that may actually affect commerce, but it hadn't been spoken of yet.
That's true, and also the Dormant Commerce Clause has kind of evolved to make fair play between the states, too, so there's not any kind of tax war that breaks out. So,
tax war. I remember the gas war.
Yeah?
There was a gas war back in the late 60s and early 70s.
Is that when the cars lined up along the gas to go to the gas stations?
No, that was the gas shortage.
Oh.
The gas war, you go down through the South, and they say gas war prices, and this guy would have it for 25 cents a gallon. This guy would have it for 19 cents a gallon. Somebody else would have it for 17 cents a gallon. They were like trying to undercut each other.
I told you about the truck war that was going on, right?
The truck war?
Yeah. So basically, the major manufacturers of trucks, you got Ford, Chevy, and Dodge.
Yeah. And the Ford plant burnt down?
Yeah, the Ford plant caught fire or something like that, so their production was slowed. And Chevy and Dodge jumped on this because they wanted to try to take Ford's percentage of sales.
So they're flooding the market.
They're all these rebates and everything like that. Good time to buy a truck. Just saying. Well, I think it's going to do it. You did pretty well on this legal briefs.
Yeah, for being totally confused the whole time. Most of that stuff you were reading, I was trying to follow where you were going with it, and I didn't even understand it.
Well, I think your confusion is sometimes just a clever facade.
A clever facade? That would have to mean that I knew something, and I don't think that's the case.
What'd you call me?
A clever what? Well, now we know that Santa has two brothers. We always thought it was just one, but now he's got Commerce Clause and Dormant Commerce Clause. His parents just weren't very creative. They just gave the other one a second name to go with his other name.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.